Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We need only say today's date, and there's a collective pause. 216 of the people killed in the attacks of September 11th, 2001, had ties to Massachusetts. At a memorial service outside the State House in Boston this morning, family members read the names of the victims.
Alberto Dominguez, Jamie Lynn Fallon, Alexander M. Filipov.
Alexander Filipov was traveling from Boston to Los Angeles for a short business trip. He planned to celebrate his 44th wedding anniversary with his wife, Loretta, when he returned.
His son, David Filipov, is a Boston Globe reporter who's written about the loss of his father and then covered the subsequent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
When we spoke with Filipov earlier today, he began by recalling the events of that morning 12 years ago.
I was in Moscow. I had actually just returned from Murmansk, where I was going to write a year anniversary story about the sinking of a Russian submarine that had been a big deal in 2000. And I'm sitting down at my desk, turn on the TV, see the buildings, go, uh-oh, turn on my email. There were no phones, right? And that's the first email that I saw.
That said that your dad was on the first plane.
That's right. I'm watching it all on TV. We're all, like, everybody transfixed, you know. At the same time, you're wondering, well, you know, maybe... you know, maybe he's okay.
Right.
You know,
of course, you
look at that now and you say, how is that possible? Especially that grainy video with the man who utters the expletive as he's shooting it. You see what happens to that plane. But, you know, I'm looking at the tower burning and I hear the announcers try to put it together. And then, of course, while we're all watching, the second plane happens and it starts to come together that this isn't just an accident. And then I start getting phone calls. Hey, do you want to talk to us? Hey, would you like to do an interview? And I got to see firsthand what it feels like when I call people to talk to them, when I'm doing an interview. Hey, you know, how do you feel about it? I mean, all journalists have suffered personal losses. And you always are thinking in the back of your mind, you know, if I were you, I wouldn't let me interview.
Exactly. I wouldn't talk.
And I've actually said that to people since. I've said, you know, I wouldn't talk to me if I were you. But at the same time, at the time, I thought it was a big enough deal that I had to talk. And it was really clear from the beginning, as horrible as it was, and later on I felt it a lot more, I felt a lot more resentful about it, that this isn't going to be just my story. This is going to be America's story, and then it's going to be the world's story when you started hearing, how are we going to get into Afghanistan to take out the Taliban?
You wrote the obituary for your dad?
Yeah, and I did a horrible job. I'd love to have that one back. As I tweeted this morning, you know, I took it really straight, you know. For all the great things he did, it was just dry obituary, as if I'd been, like, you know, the intern. He's a genius. He was an inventor. He was an electric engineer. He would try to learn the sentence, where is the good Chinese food here, in as many languages as possible, because he figured if you go up to somebody and say it, like in Swedish, they'll figure you're somebody who can talk to them.
And your mom has become very active since this happened. She actually started a forum in your dad's memory, and she's written about it. Tell us about her.
She became this vibrant, necessary, combative, sometimes convinced person who joined Peaceful Tomorrows, who marched to Washington with a caisson, you know, who got really involved. She was in a group that saw a violent response as a bad idea. Then it redoubled that when the Iraq war. And I had to cover these wars. I went to Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan 3 weeks after 9/11. I had to cover it, you know, as an American reporter who covers a war. I didn't get to have a peace agenda or an anti-war agenda. That was a constant source of tension.
It must have been so difficult to be covering, you know, a war that was in response to this attack. I mean, how?
You know, it was and it wasn't. You get to Afghanistan, there was nearly three decades of civil war prior to us arriving, and everyone you'd meet. So, yeah, I lost a brother, last year. You know what I mean? It was the perfect place to be for a reporter whose loved one was killed on September 11th because everybody could relate.
What about now, 12 years later? And you look at things. I did read some of the things that your mom had written about, saying that she tries not to think about what might have been had there been proper warnings, had there been proper information about what we knew before the 9/11 attacks, had there been communication among the federal agencies involved. And here we are in 2013, 5 months after the Marathon bombings, where it appears that we have some of the same similar issues that we had 12 years ago.
I think that, for me, the question of security and preventing an attack is a big deal. But a huge part of this for me is we went into Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban. And I look back at some of my stories, and I hate that I was sort of calling it. You know, this is much more complicated. It's hard to say where the Taliban is and where it gave up and where it went away and where it just sort of like turned, you know, put down their weapons and join the rest of the population. And it was clear that this is going to require work. Our generals were saying, we're not going to repeat the mistakes. And then it all went away. We went and did something else, which ripped through our troops, ripped through the country's resolve. And then when you go back to Afghanistan, like I did in 2011 and the 10-year anniversary of September 11th, and found that the Taliban was back in the places I'd watched it surrender. It's just devastating to think that that is a mistake that we probably made that cost so many lives, and it's still a huge mess. Who knows what would have been in Afghanistan and how long it would have been if that had been the focus of our war on terror. I don't know if you can prevent a terrorist attack anytime you want to, but you could definitely make a plan for how are you going to solve the country that housed the terrorist who planned the attack.
But then how do you feel about something like Syria now?
So the first question you have is Syria and Afghanistan where we need to go in and we can fix something? Or is it Iraq where we're going to create a problem that is worse than the problem that was there? And, you know, Vladimir Putin is not behind us right now. He's working really hard to make Russia a huge player. And, you know, his gain and his goal is always think of Russia as a big, big, important place. That little plan that he, you know, has worked out, if that ends up being the solution here that allows us to get away from that conflict without having to go in militarily and therefore create a chain reaction that could be as devastating as some of these other wars, that'll be ironic, but there you go. There's diplomacy for you. Mm-hmm. I think that actually firing rockets at Syria in the hope that that's going to stop somebody who's willing to gas his own people from gassing them some more when he's already embattled and, you know, embroiled in this deadly, vicious, brutal conflict. I think that at least requires a lot of thought before you just go and support it.
How does it not make you bitter?
Journalists. Journalists don't get bitter. We write stories. You know, I wrote that one in 2011. You know, the people there are trying really hard. It's not like our troops are incompetent. It's not like our plan is incompetent. You know, if I were going to bitter about everything that I've seen that didn't work out, I'd be a nasty, bitter old, bent old man. And I can't afford to be that because I have a son and he doesn't want his dad at 50 to be a bitter old man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, look around. We're going to walk outside right now. It's a sunny day. Most of the people are enjoying themselves. And, you know, when you go to a place like Afghanistan, people are enjoying themselves. But everywhere I've been as a war reporter, 99.44% of the people you meet just want to tell you their story, feed you, listen to your stories, and send you on your way happier than when you met them. That's what the world is. The problems are made of such a small amount of people. And when you realize that, you go to a place like Afghanistan or Chechnya, and you realize it's people who want to have a peaceful life. It's not being possible because of something that isn't working out. And if you can get to what's not working out and explain it to people and make a difference somehow, then you don't need to be bitter. You can be an optimist.
David Filipov is a reporter for the Boston Globe. His father, Al Filipov, died on American Airlines Flight 11 on September 11th, 2001. He was 70 years old. David, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to take time now to remember another 9/11 victim and an extraordinary story about a remarkable person.
Danny Lewin was a young mathematical genius who wrote a set of algorithms that would create a faster, better internet. After struggling for years to make ends meet, he co-founded Akamai Technologies, the hugely successful internet content delivery network that made him a billionaire almost overnight.
And here's the connection to 9/11. He was aboard American Airlines Flight 11 that took off from Boston. Nobody alive knows for sure exactly what happened before the jet crashed into the World Trade Center. But cell phone calls from flight attendants aboard the doomed flight said a business class passenger sitting in Danny Lewin's seat fought with and was killed by the hijackers.
And the cockpit is not answering their phone. And there's somebody stabbed in business class. And there's we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something.
Can you describe the person that you said someone is what in business class?
I'm sitting in the back. Somebody's coming back from business. If you can hold on for 1 second,
sure.
They're coming back.
They want to know who thinks stabbed who, you know? I don't know, but Karen and Bobby got stabbed.
Okay. Our number one is got stabbed. Our cursor is stabbed. Nobody knows who stabbed who, and we can't even get up to business class right now because nobody can breathe.
So it's believed that Danny Lewin was the first person killed on 9/11. The story of his brief life, he was only 31 when he died, his huge accomplishments and his death is told by journalist Molly Knight Raskin in her new book, No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the internet. And I mispronounced Molly Knight's name. Molly Knight Rankin joins us from Argo Studios in New York. And Molly, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you. First of all, it's been more than a decade since 9/11. Why has it taken 10 years to finally get a book about Danny Lewin's story out?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, but the first is, as I see it, is really just grief. I think it's just that those closest to him for a long time were reluctant to dig into those memories and share them. And there were stories about Danny from time to time, and there were some of his friends who did speak publicly. But there were a lot of folks who just really weren't ready. And something changed around the 10th anniversary. At that time, I produced a short tribute to him for Akamai Technologies, and that's when I learned about Danny. And I think at that point in time, just people were ready. I think another reason is also that the facts that came out of 9/11 commission report and investigation of what we knew happened on Flight 11 were for some time a bit conflicting and confusing. And so I think there was a reluctance in the general consciousness to refer to him as a hero on the flight.
Mm. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, I want to hear what you can tell us about what we know about what happened on that flight. But first, let me ask you just a little bit more about him. He was only 31 when he was killed. He lived life in a big way, though. What was he like? What drew you to his personal story?
Well, he was incredibly just honestly a delightful subject to write about because, as described in countless interviews with people who knew him the best, he was colorful, charismatic, brilliant, at times brash, but also very funny, very quick-witted, and also very physically imposing, not in a way that was necessarily intimidating, but people kept referring to this feeling that they got when he was in the room, that he would just take the air out of the room in a way that left an impact on everybody who was around him or in his sphere. And I just found that fascinating for someone who was so young to make this personal impact on people who had met him only a couple of times. He was almost larger than life, as described by so many people I interviewed for the book.
Really interesting. And of course, he accomplished a huge amount in his brief professional life. He was a mathematical genius, went to MIT, collaborated with Professor Tom Leighton, and basically comes up with a set of mathematical algorithms that transformed the internet. Can you tell us what he actually did, how that changed the internet as we've come to know it and use it?
Sure. Well, I mean, he did accomplish a great deal in a very short time, you know, at a time when a lot of us were still figuring out, you know, school and education and career path. Danny was working on his master's thesis at MIT as a graduate student in computer science. Specifically, he was in CSAIL, enrolled at CSAIL, which is the computer science and now computer science and artificial intelligence lab at MIT. And for his master's thesis, he was working on an idea or a set of algorithms that he believed would speed up delivery of content on the internet. And when he first came up with this idea, it was less practical than it was theoretical, but he had some idea that it might work. And he took this idea to Professor Tom Leighton at MIT, who's now the chairman of Akamai. And, you know, at first there were a couple people who looked at Danny's work and didn't understand it and didn't think it had any practical applicability. And he then took it to Tom, and the way Tom describes it, Tom Leighton, it was almost instantly he looked at it and saw something really beautiful in this very complex math. Hmm. And essentially it was a set of algorithms that he wrote. He called this set of algorithms consistent hashing. And with them, he developed this idea to basically create a set of servers or a layer of servers on top of the internet that could transmit information faster and more efficiently through these various channels and sort of circumvent all the traffic jams of the internet as it was then in the late 90s, which was very congested and sometimes very slow.
Yeah. And so it really, it worked though, right? I mean, that's...
It did work. Yeah. You know, it that's what I love too about the story is that, yeah. You know, it was a master's thesis. It was a bunch of equations and math on paper. And, you know, it really did take them some time. They ended up building a prototype at MIT over the summer of 1998 where Tom Leighton had all these math whiz kids, hackers, you know, building a prototype of setting up servers in the computer lab. You know, the seventh floor was London. The first floor was New York. And seeing if they could simulate this network that they would build. And it did work. And the really fascinating and exciting thing was the more information they loaded these servers with, the better the whole system functioned.
Mm. So we mentioned, of course, he co-founded Akamai Technologies with Tom Leighton. What happened at Akamai when he was killed? How did people that you spoke to there, how did they respond? How do they remember him?
Well, everybody describes it as the darkest day, personally and professionally, for the company, for everybody who knew him. It was just a really tragic irony that morning Danny had boarded a plane to go to Los Angeles for a business meeting. And at that time, Akamai was struggling. It was the dot-com bust, and their customers were going out of business, and things were looking rough. And then quite suddenly and horrifically, they lost Danny, who they all referred to as the heart and soul of the company. And it was a horrible day, and they found out pretty quickly that he had been on the flight. Someone had been on the phone with him up until literally the moment the flight took off.
So we began this segment talking about what we think happened aboard American Airlines Flight 11 on that day. What did you learn? How do we know what happened? What happened?
Well, the truth is we don't know exactly what happened on that flight. It happened very fast, and we know what we know from the 9/11 Commission and subsequent reports. Piecing together the facts and fragments of the calls down from those flight attendants, which you played, and those still to this moment are so chilling and horrifying to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know for a fact that the passenger in Danny's seat in 9B, which we know was his seat from the passenger manifest, had been stabbed. And basically what I did in this book was take that evidence, which over the years his friends have believed to be conclusive that he was engaged in some kind of a struggle. But then I went ahead and interviewed over 100 people who knew Danny really well and really asked them to tell me what they really thought happened on that flight. And again, the truth is we'll never know. But if you put together the facts as gathered by the 9/11 Commission, which says he may well have been the first victim and he may have fought back, together with the anecdotal evidence which unanimously supported the idea that he would never have gone down without a fight.
And I mean, we should say here, just because our listeners, many of our listeners don't know this, he moved to Israel. He trained with an elite counterterrorism unit of the Israeli Defense Forces, so he knew how to fight back.
That's right. And so that was my third point, was if you take all of that anecdotal evidence, the facts, and combine it with the fact that he had served in the most elite counterterrorism unit in Israel, it's hard to envision a scenario in which he didn't do something.
Yeah. It's such an amazingly sad irony, tragic irony. I mean, here's a man who was young, brilliant, a genius, right at the beginning of this extraordinary career, also trained to fight these battles, who was killed by these terrorists. What a story.
Yeah, it's really chilling to think that, when I looked at the flight manifest where Danny was sitting, I mean, he could have reached out an arm and been in contact with Mohammed Atta, the horrible, mastermind of the attacks. And it's also hard to believe that with his instincts and his knowledge of terrorism and his, he even had, rudimentary knowledge of spoken Arabic. And, we know from that day that there's likely to have been some verbal cues between the terrorists on the flight. Mm. And sitting in such close proximity to them, I spent a lot of time wondering, what he must have known and when. And, the irony there is really horrible.
Molly, one last question. I just have to ask you to explain the title, No Better Time.
Sure. It's a great question. The title was inspired by the idea that, Danny was a complex character and he excelled at a lot of things, almost too many things, in a way that sometimes didn't make sense to me. But there was one theme that ran throughout his life that I found really the most compelling, perhaps, which was this idea that our time is short and we have to make the most of it. And even at a young age, he had this uncanny sense of it that was really truly inspiring and fascinating to me.
Molly Knight Raskin's new book is No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Danny Lewin is believed to be the first victim of the 9/11 attack. Molly Knight Raskin, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. Up next, allegations of sexual assault in Somerville High School and questions about hazing on sports teams. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.